Well, it might seem a little bit strange to have the final Christmas message, and here it is, Epiphany, the first main Sunday on January 8th of 2017. But we're giving some of the lesser known messages and characters of the Christmas story, and the events, especially that happened after Christmas. Last week we spoke about Mary and Joseph, the obedience to the Lord in the on the eighth day after Jesus was born in his circumcision as part of the Jewish covenant. And then on 40 days with Anna and Simeon in the temple, the sacrifices that were made. I remember the Sunday school teacher who asked her class to draw a picture of what the Christmas story meant to them. And each child showed up the picture. Some had a manger scene, some had the stars, some had angels floating around, all sorts of different pictures. And then one little girl had a picture of an airplane with two people and a baby in the back and the pilot in the front. And the teacher, as she stood up to show that picture to the class, teacher said, "What does that have to do with the Christmas story?" And the little girl said, "Well, this is Mary and Joseph and the baby Jesus on the flight to Egypt." And the teacher said, "Well, who is flying it?" And she said, "Pontius the pilot." Well, maybe not quite all the understanding that we adults would have. But remember that for about 2 years after Jesus was born, Mary and Joseph lived in a little house in Bethlehem. Joseph, being a carpenter, could get enough work to keep body and soul together even well after the required time that they needed to be there. They were dirt poor. Remember, their offerings did not include a lamb, but because they were in such poverty at that time. But at about age two, the world revolved from night to day, to quote a little bit of the Christmas song, for the couple, as the wealth of kings were given to them. And the events rapidly transpire as to how God was working, how God was leading, how God was directing, how God was moving this young family with a two-year-old Messiah. And then over the next 5 years, as they were in Egypt and then back in Judea and then finally back in Nazareth, probably with more children by that time. And that's the focus we want to give. C.S. Lewis said that if a man like Jesus was just merely a man and said the strange things that he did, he wouldn't be the great teacher that the world claims Jesus to be. He wouldn't be a prophet, and he certainly wouldn't be the Messiah. He'd be a lunatic on the level with a man saying, "I'm a poached egg," or else he would maybe be the demon from hell itself. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or he was a madman or something worse. And so C.S. Lewis said that he's not left the choice to us to think about what Jesus was, but that Jesus proclaimed himself to be the Son of God, and that every part of the story reveals it. And so in this Advent series, we've seen the Messiah prophesied, named ahead of time, then all the different events of Bethlehem as a little Braphos, a little baby in arms. Braphos is the Greek word for a nursing baby. Then the term changes to a Paideon, which sounds like something from Star Wars. I'm not sure. Padman or something. Anyway, the idea being a young child now, no longer a nursing baby, but a young child. And so that's where we see him today. We'd encourage you to turn to Matthew chapter 2. We're going to pick up right at the end of the wise men story in verse 9 and continue on through verse 23 as we look at this final message I called the postlude to Christmas. What happened after the manger? What happened after the first 40 days? What happened to the couple? The first thing that we want to focus on is the principle that we should leave our direction up to God. That God will lead us day by day, step by step, and that we need to recognize that He is in charge. And so we see, first of all, under this principle, the progression in Matthew 2, verse 9, as a star guided them. Behold, the star that they'd seen when it rose and went before them until it came and stood over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. Remember, they'd been to see King Herod. In spite of knowing where the Messiah would be, the people around him didn't care. They said they were in Jerusalem. They'd lost in the lights of the city, the star altogether. But they said, go to Bethlehem, just 6 miles or so south of Jerusalem, little nothing town built on a hillside. And the story is now that the star that they had seen and then lost now is visible again. And it came and actually stood over the place where the young child was, so that they would know exactly what house and where it was. Adam Clark, the commentator, says that this was probably a special meteor that was created with a long tail as big as a kite, if you want to start singing another Christmas song, a tail that went down from the meteor. Because remember, a meteorite speeds across the sky and it's gone in a second. A meteor or a comet goes very, very slowly. You'll see it in the sky for days upon days. You'll see this as it progresses across there and leaving a large tail behind it. And they said it was some sort of a heavenly designed that it would go there and that the tail would point down to the right house. Well, Adam Clark was not there and neither was Bob, and I'm not going to second guess exactly how it was, but the wise men were wise enough to know this is the leading, the guiding star. This is the place where the Messiah would be. No longer in a stable, obviously, 2 years later, but in a home. And they came there to that place, and they gave worship. As we read in verse 11, the first part of verse 11, on arriving at the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary. They bowed down and worshiped him. I love this picture. These are literally the wise magi, the royal kings of Persia, who were Zoroastrian priests. That's what their priests were called, magi, who studied the skies. They studied the prophecies. They'd read in Daniel all the details of the Messiah coming. And Daniel gave great details as to when this would happen. And if you do the math in Daniel, you come up to that the Messiah would be born about 767 BC. And they saw the star and they headed off for months it took them after they discovered all this and realized what was happening. And figuring that the Messiah was probably already about two by then, they still came with their gifts. But the first thing they did was worship him. I love that. Now, some scriptures will say they bowed down. But the word here is literally that they prostrated themselves, that they fell out with their face to the ground in front of Jesus, the young two-year-old. They didn't worship Mary. Just thought I'd mention that in case some of you have friends or family that are in that cultic group that worship the mother instead of the son. More important than their gifts was their worship. And even here, the child is mentioned first. That's something you just don't do in ancient literature. You mentioned the adults and the child would come afterwards. It must have been a curious sight to see this caravan coming to Bethlehem loaded with these wealthy, wise men, and the first thing that they do is fall on their face in front of the baby Jesus. I can imagine Mary is there and holding Jesus and said, I left the light on, just come on in. But no, they had gifts, they had all this activity, but that came secondary. Their worship came first. And they wanted to give their gifts to God, and they gave them to the child. Now, you say, well, he was 2 years old. What does a child that's two do with the gift? He tears the paper and plays with the box, right? That's what two-year-olds do. But they trusted the parents would handle the gift as it would be needed. Just like when you came to church today and you brought your gifts to the Lord. You give it in our offering. You trust that the people who are in charge here will use it wisely, just like they trusted that Mary and Joseph would use the money that they gave at that time. And by the way, we try to do that. That's why we give so much of our money from the church here to Third World Missions. And so we see what happened here. Jesus is now a two-year-old. The men are worshiping him. Verse 11 continues, they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and of incense and of myrrh. They saw the need. They wanted to give him special gifts. Obviously, gold, the most precious, the most costly thing that they could give. Incense, that speaks of divinity. Remember, in the temple, incense would be given and it represented the prayers up to God. Of the people, and myrrh, the ointment that was used in death. You say, well, did the wise men understand that Jesus was the king and that he was worthy of their gold and he was God and they were offering incense up and that they knew he was going to die and be the Messiah and need the myrrh? I'm not sure the wise men understood any of that. What they understood was that God revealed to them the Messiah would be born, and they brought the best things they had, the costliest, the most important. How useful would the gold be as Joseph and Mary and the baby would leave literally within a couple of hours to go and live in Egypt? The cost of the journey and to maintain life there. You see, the Heavenly Father knew. He knew what Joseph and Mary and the baby would need, even before they knew it. I'm sure they were just dumbfounded, this poverty-stricken family would have this wealth. God anticipated their needs, and I'm thankful. I think we could all give testimony of that, that God at times has anticipated our needs. And we'll get something, and we'll say, wow, that was unexpected. And then something will happen, and we'll say, now I see what God was doing. He was preparing, he was blessing, he was planning. We often look in my wife's illness, like she went through and nearly dead, unable to breathe and hardly function. And the doctor said she only has a few months to live. And we just kind of scratched our heads and said, why, Lord? Why would this happen? What's going on here? But God healed her and then gave her such clarity of mind that she said, I need to go and study. I need to be able to help and learn the thing so that I can help other people. And now for, what is it, almost 25 years that she's had her clinic now, helping thousands of other people who have totally different needs, but God used her in that condition to and we didn't even understand it at the time. Do you all realize that her illness is why we moved to Wyoming? We left our position in Dallas at the university there and moved out here because her parents lived here. The doctors there said, you're going to need help raising those three children, and she's going to die. And so we came out here so she could be near her parents in her last days, and then I could have their help in raising our children. That was our plan. God, what is our line? Man plans, God laughs. Yep, we all know, you know, we plan and God laughs. He had it all down there. By the way, Jesus came and was seen by the shepherds, the Jews first, and then the Gentile wise men. He came to the humble and ignorant first, out in the manger, and then the rich and the powerful. He came to the poor, then to the wealthy. But when both groups saw Jesus, whether it was the shepherds or the wise men, they all humbled themselves and bent down and worshiped. The urgency to worship God now, not later. Finally, as we see God's direction in all of this, and we seek to understand what he's doing, we see what happened with the wise men. The wise men were directed by God to go home a different route. Now, you can see, as they would have come from the Fertile Crescent down through Syria, they had a choice of either coming down the King's Highway or down the Via Maris, the way of the sea. And they had chosen to come down the King's Highway, and then following the star had taken the crossroad that led them through Jericho, Ramah. The Arabs, the Muslims run it now, so they've changed it to Ramallah because they had to put Allah in the middle of it. But Ramah and then Jerusalem, where they found out that it was in Bethlehem, and here they were in Bethlehem. And we read in verse 12 of the text that being warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their own country by another route. They went a different way. People said, well, how could that be? The only way, you know, unless you go way out into the desert to Beersheba and around to the bottom and up through some canyons, they could finally come there. They didn't realize that there's a little shortcut. Just that I'd mentioned this. I wasn't there, but this is my thinking. When they left Bethany or Bethlehem, they went down to the shores of the Dead Sea through the Judean wilderness here. And they went down through and they crossed over right here. You say, how'd they get across? The Dead Sea is 1,300 feet deep on this end, and at most 13 feet deep on this end. Most of the time, this was a waist deep. You could go across on horses or camels or anything, cross over this little narrow isthmus to the Lysan Peninsula, and then head back, bypassing Jerusalem, bypassing King Herod, who wanted to kill Jesus. And so they departed. The King James says they departed another way, and I thought, yeah, they met Jesus. They'd be different. It would be a different way that they departed. But it's literally just a different route that they took so that they would not give back to Herod the message of that they had found Jesus or that where he was at. And it's amazing. That night, they left with this large entourage of people, camels and that, now with some of their burden gone because they'd given this wealth to the Holy Family. But then they left down through the wilderness, and I think the Hebrew word is bamboozled. Or maybe that isn't Hebrew, maybe that's from my Italian background. But anyway, they bamboozled Herod. They tricked him, and so that they didn't give away. We see a wonderful pattern here. Those who look for Jesus will find him. Those who worship him will give of themselves and their wealth to him. The politicians like Herod, the scribes, the religious leaders, they hated the idea of a new king being born. They were looking to kill him. They were indifferent to the idea of a Messiah. But the wise men still sought him. So, whether it is your direction from Jericho to Bethlehem or leaving Bethlehem a different way, let God lead. God wants to direct our life. Someone said, well, I look for God's leading. I take my Bible and I page through with my eyes closed. And then I put my finger down on a verse and say, I'm going to follow what that verse says. And they looked at the verse and it said, and Judas went out and hung himself. And so they quickly opened the Bible up again and moved through the pages with their eyes closed and hit another verse, and they opened it up and it said, go and do thou likewise. Well, that's not what we mean by God leading, by God directing. That isn't how we find his direction. We find it in his word, but we find it through the study of it as his spirit leads us to understand what he's saying. So, principle one, leave the direction to God. Principle number two is leave the defense up to God. Because now, the Holy Family, Joseph, Mary, and the baby, are in trouble. The wise men leave, and we read in verse 13, which nobody does when they're talking about the Christmas story. They always quit in verse 12, just like we did in our scripture reading earlier this morning as we began our worship. Verse 13, when they left, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. Get up, he said, take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the Messiah, search for the child to kill him. This command was urgent. It was direct. Joseph knew this was God giving him a message and that he had to do everything in his power to defend, to keep safe this little two-year-old who was helpless to keep himself safe. He was just learning how to walk and talk. Can you imagine the God, the creator of the world, learning to potty train? It's a humbling thought. But he was told to go to Egypt, and I thought, what a strange thing, because Egypt in the Bible always seems to be negative. That's a bad place. You don't want to go to Egypt. Matter of fact, in our next series of messages beginning in March, we're going to be speaking on Exodus 1 to 20. And you need to pray about that, because I'm already up to about 40 messages, and it's growing every day. So just recognize that day is coming. But Egypt is always negative in my thinking. But in reality, the Nile Valley in Egypt, which is off of our map down here, the Nile Valley had over 1 million Jews. Alexander the Great founded a city which he cleverly named after himself, Alexandria, up in the delta of the Nile, and made it an open city where people of any religion, any ethnicity could come and find no persecution. They had freedom of religion. In a very interesting thing for that back in the 3rd or 4th century B.C. But this was a hotbed of Judaism. The only place in the world where there were more Jews living than in Judea, the second largest group were in Galilee, and the third largest were in the Nile Valley of Egypt. The Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament for the Jews who couldn't read Hebrew anymore, scattered throughout all the world, that was translated right there in Egypt. And so when the angel said, go to Egypt, because King Herod is after you. King Herod was the king of this land, basically, of Judea and Samaria and Galilee. The whole region was under his kingship that Rome had allowed him to maintain control. He said, you need to get out of his realm, because he's going to kill the child. So Egypt is the next closest and natural place outside of Herod's jurisdiction, a very civilized place where they could leave and where they could flee. And that it was a good logical choice for the Lord to tell Joseph to take his family there. By the way, Herod was crazy. You say, you're talking about Herod the Great? The guy who built the temple, built the tomb of the patriarchs, it's still in Hebron today, that did all these different great works? Yeah, that Herod. He was absolutely a megalomaniac. He enjoyed killing people. His wife, he married the daughter of the high priest so that he could kind of get in with the Jews, and because he wanted to be the king of the Jews, of all of this area. His wife Miriam, the daughter in the line of John Hyrcanus, the high priest, he didn't love her anymore. He wanted to get rid of her, and unlike Henry VIII, he didn't have an axeman close that he could just chop her head off, couldn't divorce her. And so he had an affair with her mother, Alexandra, and then convinced Alexandra to testify that his wife was cheating on him. And so she did, and he killed her, had her executed. And by the way, then he had her mother, Alexandra, his mother-in-law had her killed, but there's another method there. And then his two sons said, wait a minute, we got to take power away from Dad. Herod has gone crazy. And so his two sons, Alexander and Aristobulus, you get the picture. He killed them too. And when King Octavian, Caesar Augustus in Rome, heard about all that Herod was doing, and that Herod, claiming to be a good Jew, wouldn't eat pigs, he said it would be safer to be Herod's pig than his son. And there's a lot of truth in that, because he just killed everybody. He was crazy. One of the most evil men possible. And so, Joseph, Mary, they knew this. And so the verses continue, verse 14 and 15. It says that he got up, took the child and his mother during that night, and left for Egypt, and stayed there until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said to the prophet, out of Egypt I've called my son. He completely ran as quickly as he could. That night, the wise men had just left off into the wilderness. He headed down to Egypt as quickly as possible with the gold, the incense, the myrrh there. The Greek word here that he is to leave is the word fugetto, which is, we get the word fugitive from that same Greek word. He's running for his life. We got to get out of here before Herod comes after us. He didn't bask in the fame of the Magi's visit, but I'm sure he did appreciate it, because he now had a coffer full of gold that's going to be able to pay the way. He had no idea how long it would be until Herod would die. We know, by the way, that Herod dies on the day of an eclipse, which is in history. You can tell the exact day in March of 4 BC that Herod dies. He's down in Egypt waiting for word, because some people estimate that he's going to spend at least 2 years in Egypt, if not 4 or 5. And the prophecy, I thought, was interesting too, because Hosea 11:1 is kind of ripped out of its context, because it's talking about how God brought Israel out of Egypt in the Exodus, that he brought his people out of Egypt and then brought them up to the promised land. And here, Matthew's saying, oh, this is a prophecy about Jesus too. It's kind of got a dual fulfillment, that God is bringing the Messiah out of Egypt as well. By the way, let me just make you think a minute here. I know you say, wait a minute, this is preaching. We're not supposed to think. Remember, we've been preaching on Elijah and Elisha. What else could God have done to protect Jesus and the family there in Bethlehem? What had happened during the time of Elijah and Elisha? When they came to kill Elijah, he went out to the brook Cherith, right? And just stayed there. In Israel, but just stayed there. He'd stayed with a widow. What else in Elijah? How did God defend Elijah? Somebody help? What's that?
Put him in the wilderness, the birds fed him.
Yeah, put him in the wilderness, let the birds feed him. Yeah. That's good.
On the prophets who fell.
Yeah, he got brought down fire from heaven and consumed all the enemy, and Elijah killed all the enemy. Couldn't God have done that to Joseph? Said, hey, Herod and his soldiers are coming, and there's Joseph, in his best Terminator accent, with his guns or swords or whatever it would be, going, No, that's not what God did. He could have blinded the soldiers like he did in Elisha's day. And Joseph led them around out into the wilderness to die. All sorts of different things, but God did the simplest thing. He did. My kids, when we were reading this story in our homeschool class, and my children were little, 12, 14 years old, as I recall, they called it the Taco Bell defense. And I said, Taco Bell defense? And he said, yeah, run for the border. I said, oh, okay, I see what you're saying. He's just saying, okay, I'm warning you, they're coming to kill you, run! And he did. He just used the ordinary message. And so verse 16 talks here about the king. Herod realized that he'd been outwitted by the Magi. He was greatly enraged. Very angry. I don't know what your translation will say, but it's got a word for really upset and then very added to it, that it's just as extreme as it can be. He was beyond control. He gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years of age or younger, ascertaining the time from the Magi. The Magi had told him when the star began, and so he figured, okay, if they were born in 7, 6, 5, 4, you go kill them all. And you don't just kill them, they're those who are here in Bethlehem itself, because they might be out of the area. You need to go there and kill any baby boy in the area. The Magi had done their first magic trick, and yes, we get the word magic from the same root as Magi. They had performed this trick, playing a game on King Herod, as they simply obeyed God's command to go back a different way. They had never said they were going to come back and report to the king. But Herod, this evil man who had killed his own children, do you think killing babies in this region is going to be a bother to him? It's no big deal at all. We don't know how many babies they were, but we know that this region is about 100 square miles. It's going to go from Bethlehem to Ramallah today, including Jerusalem, all the area around here. He said, we're going to kill them all. We're talking probably hundreds or thousands of baby boys that are killed at this time, perfectly in harmony with Herod's wicked demeanor. He was not just angry, he was furious, and not just a little furious, he was very furious. And so they killed them all, and I'm sure Herod wiped his hands of it and said, there, we've taken care of this rival king of the Jews. He's dead for sure. We got him. By the way, a year later when Herod is going to die and he's ghastly sick, it's amazing to read in the history books. He decides and realizes that when he dies, no one is going to mourn his death. No one is going to be upset that he's dead. They're all going to be happy. One of his sons will take over, and he'll be forgotten, and Herod the Great will be no more. And so what he did was he ordered all of the Jewish leaders that lived in Jerusalem arrested, kept under lock and key, to wait for his death. And then on his death, the soldiers were to kill them all. He said that way there will be crying and weeping and mourning all over Israel on the day I die. Thankfully, the soldiers, when Herod died, simply went to the jails and let free all the prisoners without killing any of them. And everyone was happy because of this evil man who did premeditatedly try to kill the Messiah. Matthew adds that this is another fulfillment of prophecy in verses 17 and 18. Then that which was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping, great mourning. Rachel, Jacob's wife, who died giving birth to Benjamin in Bethlehem. Rachel, weeping for her children, refusing to be comforted because they are no more. This is Jeremiah 31:15. All of the Jewish mothers, all related to Rachel, is kind of like the mother of their nation. As she gave birth to her baby, Joseph's little brother Ben, that she died in childbirth. And now here, the picture is given of the weeping in this entire region from Ramah to Bethlehem, this 100 square miles of Jewish women all wailing and weeping as an entire generation of baby boys was killed. Herod wasn't trying to fulfill prophecy. I don't think Herod had a clue. But God had already shown by the prophet Jeremiah that this was going to happen. By the way, if you read further in Jeremiah chapter 31, the last couple of verses, after saying, you know, that this judgment's going to come, and by the way, it did. Jeremiah wrote this. King Nebuchadnezzar, this is 587 B.C., came in, destroyed Jerusalem, killed hundreds of thousands of people, and then ordered a mass deportation of the people from the area to Babylon. The people left, and 5 miles northeast of Jerusalem at Ramah is the last high ground where people could turn and look and see Jerusalem. And they saw the fires and they saw the smoke and they saw the temple of God burning and being destroyed. And they knew of all the hundreds of thousands who'd been killed in that war. Jeremiah's prophecy was fulfilled in his lifetime, as the voice of wailing in Ramah was heard. But what no one understood was this was a prophecy that would have dual fulfillment 500 years later at the time of Herod's evil actions on the people of Israel at that time. And so his verses conclude in that chapter of Jeremiah 31. Stop your voice from weeping. Wipe your eyes from tears. For there is a reward for your work, declares the Lord. And you shall come back from the land of the enemy. There is hope for your future and your children as you return to your land. Wonderful truth here that gave confidence to a generation 580 BC and should be giving confidence to the generation that had lost all those baby boys there. God defends. We don't understand why. We don't always understand how, but we need to leave it up to God to defend. We use our wisdom. You know, they got the word, go to Egypt. They went. There was no question. Wait there till Herod's dead. We're going to wait. But God took care of them. We spoke today in our sharing and prayer time that today is the 61st anniversary of the death of the missionaries that were serving up in the upper Amazon in Ecuador in the jungles, and they landed after giving gifts to the native men, and then they landed to share the gospel with them, and they were all killed. Jim Elliott, Nate Saint, and the others. And how that motivated an entire generation to go and volunteer to serve the Lord. And I wonder if God will have to do that again to motivate our kids who are driven by their jobs, by their wealth, by their parents, by their peers, and not serving the Lord. One of the reasons that I went off to college to study to be a minister is because of the stories of heroes like these who gave their lives. They did not die in vain. We didn't all understand it, but we saw the great benefit. But you realize that the generation that went off to college and studied and out to the mission field, how old are they now? Well, thank you, Beth. Old. Yeah, they're my age. Going to be 70 or older. And they're retiring. And for every 40 missionaries who come back from the field, one goes out. Do you think the loss of the greatest generation of our World War II vets is bad for the world? The loss to Christianity is devastating as our outreach becomes less and less effective, fewer and fewer involved. God did it. We didn't understand it, but God took care of them. You say, they were killed. Because sometimes that's God's plan for us to die. Because the blood of martyrs is the seed of the church. That quotation comes, by the way, from 130 AD, one generation after the apostles, because so many were being killed. The blood of martyrs is a seed of the church. That's how we grow. Leave it up to God, we learn, principle number two. And then principle number three, don't sweat the small stuff. Leave the direction up to God, leave the defense up to God, leave the details up to God. We've got to make it a nice, clever outline. Leave the details up to God. Don't sweat the petty stuff. Don't pet the sweaty stuff. I don't know exactly how you'd say it today, but don't worry about it. Let God work out the details. God's providence, his plan is going to work. We can go kicking and screaming into the night, or we can acquiesce and say, thy will be done. As Jesus did in Gethsemane. Matthew 2:19 picks up simply after Herod died. We're not told when. It's a continuous action. We have no idea. It might be a year or two. An angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, get up, take the child. There it is, the baby mentioned first again. Take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for those who were trying to take the child's life are dead. We don't know all the details. We don't know what happened here. By the way, this is the only place, these verses, this is all we know about Jesus at this time of life. Now, there were some what are called infancy gospels or infancy accounts that were spread all over the world saying, oh, this is what happened when Jesus was a little toddler. This is what happened when Jesus was in Egypt. This is what happened when Jesus was a little boy. And they tell wonderful stories. I've read them, required for pastoral studies, about how Jesus, all the children were making clay figures by the stream. And Jesus made a bird, and then he blew on it, and it came to life, and it flew away. Sounds cool. They said that Jesus had other children who were teasing him about being born to a woman who wasn't married yet. And so he spoke the word and blinded the eyes of all the neighborhood children. Sounds like a good story. How he went to a place in Egypt where there was an idol, and the baby Jesus just stared at it until with his super x-ray vision it exploded the head of the idol. Sounds like a cool story. I think Steven Spielberg should get a hold of these, don't you? That he could come up with the Raiders of the, well, whatever that would be, one of the Indiana Jones. I could see this coming on there real well. And some of my charismatic friends would appreciate this story, that Jesus took some of the original swaddling bands that he had, those little white strips of cloth that the poor people had to wrap their babies in. He later took those and kissed them and laid them on people, and the magic of their kiss and those little cloth healed them of their diseases. And so those cloths were passed all around the world to give divine healing through the swaddling cloths of Jesus. Well, those stories aren't in the Bible for a reason. They're not in keeping with anything of what the Bible teaches. They're simply fanciful stories of men that people wanted to know more information, and I don't blame them. I hear little bits and pieces, and I immediately do what? I want to know. I hear yesterday of 15 gunshots at the college where my grandson is. I Google and look it up and all over there, and there's nothing. Teresa asked me this morning, she said, what did you learn? I said, I learned that the city of Rockford didn't want to spread that bad news and publicity out. And so it was simply a police report and then nothing more. I'll get the skinny because I'll dig and prod my grandson until he tells me all the details of it, of what was on there, because that's the kind of person I am. So I'm sure that people these days say, well, here's Jesus. We don't know anything. He goes to Egypt. Now he can come back, and we don't know anything. So we'll make up stories that sound good. We'll listen to old wives' tale and gossip and find out what it would be. And so here he's given the message, the all clear, that he can go back to Israel. Verse 21 continues, so he, Joseph, got up, took the child and his mother, and returned to Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning in Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. When Herod died, there was no single heir to take over his kingdom, and so it was divided among four sons. They're called tetrarchs, tetra meaning four. They each ruled a fourth of it. One ruled in Judea, Samaria, one ruled in Galilee, one ruled up on the other side. And you'll hear them in the Bible, Philip the Tetrarch, and Herod Agrippa, and different ones. These are his sons that are ruling there. And he hears that Archelaus, and Archelaus, by the way, has all the evil character of his father Herod, but none of the greatness. He doesn't do anything good. He's just the same evil person. And here Mary and Joseph get the word, okay, you can go back to Israel. And they come back and go, wait a minute. Archelaus is ruling here. We got to be careful or he's going to kill us. He's going to do what his father Herod couldn't do. So he was cautious of this. Josephus, the historian, writes that Archelaus was a man of kindred nature to his father, suspicious and truculent. I had to look up the word truculent. That's bad, okay? It doesn't mean he drove a Ford F-150. It means he was bad, that he was uncontrollable. And by the way, the Jews were so upset with him that the Jews in Judea said, we don't want any of Herod's sons to be our ruler. And so the Romans said, okay, we'll send you a governor. We'll send him in Caesarea at the seaport. He'll be the capital, and he will be the governor for this region. A few governors later comes Pontius Pilate. That's how come he is there ruling in this area. He's the governor because the Jews deposed Archelaus. They said, we don't want this guy. We're done with this. They wanted to come back, but they had to wait till Archelaus was dead too. So Joseph is careful. He's concerned. I'm sure his plan was to return to Bethlehem. He had family there. He had friends there. He had worked there for 2 years. People knew him. What he didn't want to do was go back to Nazareth, where his former home was, where Mary had been found to be pregnant and had left in shame. He didn't want to go back there for sure. He wanted to stay in Bethlehem. This, nobody knew the backstory. Nobody knew about Mary as a unwed mother. So he had his own plans to thwart Scripture. Well, Joseph didn't think about it as thwarting Scripture, but he had his own plans as to how this would be. Augustine in 400 writes that Joseph had the idea of settling somewhere near Jerusalem because that's where the Messiah should be. But God had a different plan. God had different details. He said, no, he needs to go back up to Galilee, up into the lower class, up into the rural hillbillies, the people that were despised by the Jews in Judea. Matter of fact, I think the Hebrew word for anybody who lived in Galilee was deplorables. Or maybe that just came from the election. I'm not sure where that came from. But the idea here is that they look down on that. So keep reading. Verse 22 continues, having been warned in a dream about Archelaus and all the mess there, he returned not to Bethlehem, but to the area of Galilee to live in the town called Nazareth. So was fulfilled what was said through the prophets, he'll be called a Nazarene. One from Nazareth. Again, God guided him. God led him. God gave him the perfect direction and the perfect details so he would be in just the perfect spot for his life. The Messiah would be raised not in the hotbed of all the priests in the temple, but up in the rural backwoods area of Galilee, often called Galilee of the Gentiles because there were more non-Jews living there than there were Jews. God judged the despised Galileans better company than the religious leaders of the temple of his day. Better training for Jesus to be one who would reach the people, not the elite. Mary had left, and now, what is it, 4, 5, maybe 6 years later, she comes back with a boy and probably other children as well. Someone said it's remarkable that Joseph went back to Nazareth because Nazareth was the most unremarkable town in the region. Nazareth was the low end of Galilee, the worst place to live. Now, I don't know about you, but when people talk about Natrona County, my county where I live, I think of one place in Natrona County, Casper. That's the only real city in the whole county, right? Wait a minute. Some of you say, wait, no. What about Mills? What about Midwest? What about Bar None? What about Glen Rock's in Converse County, isn't it? What else is in Moneta? I'm trying to think of anywhere else in Edgerton, in Natrona County. Now you say, what?
Highland.
Yes, population 3. You know, that's like going to Nazareth. If you're going to go to Natrona County in the middle of Wyoming, Lord knows you're already in the middle of nowhere, right? It's not the end of the world, but you can see it from our porch, right? It's out in the middle of nowhere. And then we're in the least little town in the middle of nowhere. That's Nazareth. But the prophets had said that he would be a Nazir, N-A-T-Z-I-R, a Nazarene, one that would be the branch. That's what the word Nazir means, the branch growing out of dry ground. This was the prophecy there. Jesus, you think about it, Jesus said, I am Jesus of Nazareth. That's how he was distinguished. His sect of followers in Acts 24, verse 5, were called the Nazarenes. And just the way we say Polish jokes or ethnic jokes about people or hillbilly jokes that live down in the mountains of nowhere, you realize most of the United States says those jokes about Wyoming. You realize that. That's how they look at us. That's what Nazareth meant. Matter of fact, one of the Jewish friends said that every time they used the word Nazareth, they would spit. They would say Nazareth. That's the lowest of the low. That's how that. Those are the hillbillies. Those are the those that are out there. But that's where God had led them. If you go back to Luke chapter 2, after all the Christmas stuff, Luke 2 skips over all this Egypt, all these years. And Luke simply says that they did everything required of the law, and then they returned to Galilee, to their own town of Nazareth. The child grew and became strong, filled with wisdom and the grace of God on him. Unconcerned about Matthew's story, Luke just says, yep, after all this happened, yep, they went back to Galilee, back to Nazareth, and Jesus grew. He'll conclude in chapter 2 of Luke that Jesus increased in wisdom, stature, and favor with God and man, in his physical and emotional and mental and spiritual life. He just grew up. The Messiah lived there and became strong. We piece together these stories of Christmas from the gospel accounts in Matthew and Luke, from the prophecies of the Old Testament. But we know that they're not a real biography, because my goodness, we've already passed 5 or more years of Jesus' life in a matter of about 30 verses in all these sermons combined. John wrote in his gospel, the last, John 20, he said, Jesus did many miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples, which aren't recorded in the book, but these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name. We don't see the particulars. We don't see how it all works, but we see the principles here. That God will direct us. He'll direct the course of history just as he did for Jesus. He'll defend us just as he did for the Holy Family. And all the details of our life, he will work out. Because he knows the big picture and we don't. We don't understand it at all. Luke will add in a minute, when Jesus was 12, this happened, a few more verses. And then nothing until Jesus is 31 or 32 years old. Not another word. But we don't need to know all those details. God does. And he worked them all out for our good and his glory. That's the principles that we need to learn from this postlude to the Christmas story.